From GPB News, this is On Second Thought. I'm Celeste Headlee. Georgia will likely put another person to death tonight. Convicted murderer Stephen Frederick Spears is scheduled for execution this evening. 30 years ago, another Georgia death row inmate with alleged mental disabilities made the country reconsider executions.
There was a good bit of controversy at the time because people wondered if he knew what he had done, if he knew the consequences of that, if he understood the punishment.
We'll revisit that case of Jerome Bowden later this hour. First, though, we devoted yesterday's program to fallout from the 2016 campaign. What about America needs to change? Here are your first thoughts.
Yeah, this is Mike. What I would change is programs like I just listened to that are very biased against Trump. Trump is a good man. Trump is going to make America great again. Hillary Clinton should be in jail. And Obama has stolen the crown from Jimmy Carter as the worst president in American history.
Kathy Lohr tweets, Middle America and rural America, too long considered flyover country, just plain wrong. And Marissa Manville tweets, I would love to see more civility and compassion in our interactions with one another. We forget that we are all in this together. We always love to get your thoughts. Whatever they may be, you can call us and leave a message like Mike did at 404-500-9457. We're on Facebook and we're also on Twitter at OST Talk. Remember, we might feature your comments on the show. Sometimes people have been trying to diversify the workforce in science and tech for a long time, over 10, 15, 20 years. But studies show it is now no more diverse than it was in the year 2000. 87% of engineers are white or Asian, 84% of computer techs, white or Asian. But there is a new effort to change that here in Georgia, and the program just got $4 million from the National Science Foundation. It's called the Peach State Lewis Stokes Alliance for Minority Participation, and we have the director with us, Angela Burks-Greer. Hi, Angela.
Hi, good morning.
It's good to have you. Also with us are seniors Brianna Moppins and Sheena Vasquez from the University of Georgia. They are both enrolled in what's called the LSAMP program. Hi, Brianna and Sheena.
Hi.
Hello.
Angela, you were nodding your head when I said that we've been trying to diversify STEM for a while. How is this program different than the efforts that have gone before?
Well, in this effort, we're truly trying to increase the number of underrepresented minorities who are completing degrees in your science, technology, engineering, mathematics areas and disciplines. And it's not just engineering and it's not just science, but it can be various careers that require those skills.
So, Brianna, what are you majoring in?
I'm a biology major, pre-med.
Okay. And Sheena, you?
I am a biochemistry and molecular biology major, and I'm pre-graduate school.
Okay. So, Brianna, do you think there were obstacles for you in terms of finishing a degree in STEM?
I do believe so, especially attending a university that doesn't really have much diversity with minorities. It's sometimes intimidating to get to know the professors, especially in a large class. LSAMP really provided the chance for you to meet faculty and to get to know them on a more personal level in a more intimate space. I believe the connections are, you know, valuable.
And what about you, Sheena?
Definitely for me as well, and especially coming in as a transfer student from a local community college in Decatur, the LSAMP program has provided a smooth transition for me with having faculty mentors like Dr. Burks-Greer that I knew previously, and also students who had transferred in from the college to UGA as well.
Okay, so Angela, you emphasized when you were explaining the difference, the fact that your program wants to help people complete the STEM majors. Does that mean you feel as though many programs before were just focused on recruiting people to them?
Well, not necessarily that they just wanted to recruit, but then we discovered that we really need to create an environment in which we have a lot of support and that we're encouraging the students to work with faculty members in research and do all that they can to get involved in internships and various other actual career type experiences in the summer during the school year too. And that's been very helpful in order for them to make connections in the classroom. It helps them to do better.
So how does the LSAMP program how does it do that? What are the different ways that it supports somebody so that they graduate successfully?
One of the things that we like to do is, engaging them in research. That's really important.
And what does that mean? You're getting them into the lab, or you're getting them on research projects?
We're getting them involved in laboratories and getting them in research projects. And then we offer them professional development workshops in which they're able to learn better how to represent themselves with their CVs or their resumes, how to do personal statements better, how to do applications better. We just give them more opportunities to better their writing skills, those other skills that are in addition to the science and math skills. We're just giving them more of a holistic approach to preparing them and getting them ready for engaging in the STEM disciplines.
Brianna, you hear Angela telling all of these different things that this program does. Which of those did you take advantage of?
Well, I'm on the student board for LSAMP, so I play a big role in designing the professional workshops and preparing that. What I really like about having a student board is it really gets the actual students more involved in figuring out, you know, what do we actually need. For example, last year we had the faculty student mixer, which is like a speed dating thing to like get to meet different faculty like really quickly. I thought it was really fun.
You have to explain this to me. It means you sit down at tables with faculty members for like 2 minutes and then a bell rings and you move to the next one?
Exactly. It's really fun. And so I like the fact that we have the students actually, you know, get to say, this is what we see the problem is, and this is what we need to work on.
So this is this $4 million grant from the National Science Foundation will be spread across 5 colleges in Georgia, not just the one, 6. Angela is holding up 6, but we're on radio, so they can't see that, Angela. 6 colleges. How do you spend that? Does that just give you further resources for the programs that you're already doing, or are you planning some new things?
Both. It gives us additional resources for what we're currently doing, and as well as giving us some resources to start really preparing students for the next step after undergraduate. We really want to focus on getting them prepared for graduate school so that they can be very successful in going after master's and PhD degrees, as well as MD PhD degrees. I would say 75% of our funding goes directly to students to give them stipends, to give them travel awards.
They have to work for those stipends, though.
They do. They have to do service outreach and help by maybe tutoring other students, being peer mentors to other students. They also have to do 10 hours per semester of service learning.
Yeah.
They are also required to apply to various research opportunities outside of the institution. We really are forcing them to really put themselves out there. And so the funding is available for them for when they do research, then they want to present their research at professional conferences. Then we provide travel awards for them to go to the conferences and present their work. Many of them do poster presentations as well as oral presentations at national conferences across this nation. And some of them even do international conferences. We also like to provide opportunities for them to do research abroad.
That is Peach State's LSAMP Director Angela Berkus-Greer. We are talking about a program that encourages minority undergrad students to enroll in STEM and graduate with those majors. We also have 2 students with us, Brianna Moppins and Sheena Vasquez. Sheena, do you have any ideas on why it has been so difficult to increase the participation of both women and minorities in STEM fields? What is the obstacle?
Personally, I think it could be lack of awareness of these opportunities on campus and available to us, and also possibly a lack of tying in with the lack of awareness, like lack of faculty members maybe making students aware of this. So something that's very nice with LSAMP is that we do have outreach and allowing students to know about these opportunities, and it's nice to have that. So in my opinion, it is in part the lack of awareness, and having peers that are part of programs like this helps us to engage fully in these opportunities.
Brianna, what about you? Do you have any clues about why this has been, in spite of there has been money poured into trying to diversify STEM fields, there has been programs focused only on this. Why is this so difficult?
I just believe there's also a wall that we have to get past. A lot of people, well, me personally, sometimes you don't have like someone to look up to, maybe to see that, oh, they've done it too. So having LSAMP, you see people, oh, they've done this, so I can do it too, you know? It can be hard to get past that, especially if you have parents who may not have done graduate school. Like for me, I didn't know the difference between getting a master's and getting a PhD until my senior year of high school. So it's just like, you know, you learn about these things kind of late, and then you feel like it's too late to, you know, go for it. So,
Angela, how many students have been involved in the LSAMP programs so far?
So in the last 5 years, we've touched roughly about 1,100 students.
Wow, that is a lot in 5 years.
Yes.
But it's spread over six
institutions.
And what kind of success have you seen? What kind of graduation rate do you have?
So from 2010 to 2014, we've seen a 94% in degrees.
94% graduation rate?
Mm-hmm. Baccalaureate degrees in STEM across those six institutions as a whole together.
That is a remarkable 94%. Statistic.
Yes, that's between 2010 and 2014.
Brianna, you said you're getting ready for medical school, correct?
Yes.
So what is it that you want to do eventually?
Well, I want to be a pediatrician in the future, but I'm also considering getting a PhD, so maybe the MD-PhD program. I'm taking a gap year, so I'm doing research during that gap year. So
you want to stay in the library for a long time.
Yes.
Sheena, what about you? What do you hope to do with your education?
I'm on the fence right now between pursuing academia or industry. So that's typically what you do after you pursue a PhD in biochemistry. So I'm leaning more towards industry right now, but I'm also flexible with maybe having my mind change to be in academia because there's a higher chance to influence future generations mm-hmm. positively, especially minority students. So that those are two fields that I'm looking at pursuing.
Angela, you're cheering here. You guys can't see her, but she's over here waving her hands. You see these two girls as successes of the program.
Absolutely. And what's really cool is I didn't talk to them at all. I didn't know what their plans were. So
you just trusted they were going to.
Well, you know, I believe that we're putting out that message. We're giving them opportunities to engage in different ways. They're being exposed to career paths in STEM that they've never even knew about or thought about. And so making those connections, I know, have been very influential and impactful in these students' lives. And so many of them come to undergrad thinking, I just want to be a medical doctor, or I just want to be a veterinarian. And we're showing them various other career paths in STEM. And that has made a huge difference.
That is Peach State LSAMP Director Angela Birx-Greer, and LSAMP has helped boost minority participation in STEM majors in six colleges across and universities across Georgia. We also heard from UGA seniors Brianna Moppins and Sheena Vasquez. Thanks so much to both of you. Brianna and Sheena, you guys both graduate in May?
Yes.
Congratulations.
Thank you.
Georgia is set to break an unusual record tonight with the planned execution of Stephen Frederick Spears. Spears is on death row for the 2001 murder of his ex-girlfriend in Dahlonega. And if he's put to death this evening as scheduled, Georgia will top Texas for the most calendar year executions in 2016. Georgia was actually pretty influential over modern public opinion on the death penalty. That's the story told in a forthcoming documentary about the case of Jerome Bowden. Bowden was executed 30 years ago after 10 years on death row for murder, but his conviction remains a mystery. Georgia officials say many of the details of his case are confidential state secrets. That includes a court-appointed IQ test that apparently found Bowden to be intellectually disabled. Paula Kaplan is a psychologist and an associate at Harvard University's Du Bois Institute. Paula is also a producer of the film American Justice, The Jerome Bowden Story. It uses reenactments of real-life events to illustrate how the court reached a guilty verdict in Jerome Bowden's case. Paula joined me recently to talk about the case along with Atlanta Journal-Constitution reporter Alan Judd. I asked Alan whether or not this case was as controversial 30 years ago as it's considered today.
At the time, there was a lot of controversy about it because of the fact that the state was executing someone with a very low IQ who apparently had some form of what was at the time referred to, of course, as mental retardation. We would now say intellectual disability. But yes, there was a good bit of controversy at the time because people thought, people wondered if he knew what he had done, if he knew the consequences of that, if he understood the punishment. And that was really the issue.
Let's hear a little bit of that documentary. The scene is a reenactment of a conversation between attorney Samuel Oates and one of the officers who arrested Jerome Bowden.
I gave him a waiver of rights form, which he read for himself aloud in my presence, along with Sergeant Hardaway and Detective Miles, indicating he understood his rights. And then he signed it in my presence.
You say he read it to you?
Yes, sir. He read it aloud.
He had no difficulty reading it?
No, sir. He understood it. He read it.
I didn't ask you if he understood it. He read...
Yes, sir.
Why, Paula, is that point, whether he read his waiver of rights form or not, why is that important?
Well, it's crucial because there was no material evidence tying Jerome Bowden to the crime. There was material evidence tying someone else to the crime. The only quote-unquote evidence of his guilt was what was presented in court as a confession that he had signed. Now, he had tested as having an IQ of only 59 when he was 14 years old. He had been in special ed in Columbus, Georgia's first special ed class when he was in first grade and all the way through. And so it was clear that he had what was called mental retardation. That made him extremely vulnerable to being persuaded to sign a false confession. And if he couldn't even read what he was asked to sign, then that confession should not even have been used. And furthermore, what we discovered in doing the research for our film is that he didn't sign just one confession. It turns out that this did not come out in the trial, but he signed not just one confession, but three different confessions at different times. And if you look at those confessions, they contradict each other and they contradict what the police found as evidence. And so it is quite likely that he either had nothing to do with the crime or was certainly not the major player in it.
So let's hear a little bit more from the documentary. This is a clip of Jerome testifying during his trial.
I told Detective Miles that I had killed Ms. Stryker and that I had stabbed her with a butcher knife and that I took jewelry and stuff from the house, stuff like this.
Jerome, did you in fact kill Mrs. Stryker?
No, I didn't.
How in the world did you think it was going to help you to confess to a crime that you now say you didn't do?
Well, I don't know. Only thing I knew, since Detective Miles had told me this here.
He told you what?
Had told me about could help me, that he could.
So, Alan, in the years since, why have we not been able to go and see more of this documentation? Why does the state still consider this to be state secrets?
The State Board of Pardons and Paroles has since the beginning, since it was set up about 60, 65 years ago, has had a pretty much total exemption to any kind of public records and public meetings law requirements. They can meet in private, they deliberate in private, they discuss in private, and all their records are private. They have the opportunity to declassify them if they choose to. And there are a number of reasons that they say they could, including historical accuracy of past events, which would seem to apply here, but they chose not to do so, and they almost never do.
We've talked about this before on the show, but how different is this from standard practice in other states?
A lot of states have a lot more openness. One of the ironies is that the parole board here was set up because of a scandal in which it appeared that the governor at the time maybe had sold some pardons. So then they set up a new board to be more, less corrupt, essentially. And it was all done in secret.
I guess transparency was not part of the less corruption then. So then, Paula, why are we still looking at this? Why is it still important today? We will get back to Jerome's story, but why does this still interest us now?
Well, it interests us now because I need to explain a little bit about this case. It was a history-making case. When in 2002 the U.S. Supreme Court said it is unconstitutional to execute people with, they use the term mental retardation, Justice Stevens named the Jerome Bowden case as pivotal in that decision, because after he was executed, when it came out that he clearly had mental retardation, then the Georgia legislature became the first state in the country to outlaw execution of people with these low IQs. Now, here's what happened. When the Georgia Board of Pardons and Paroles was contacted by Jerome's final appeals lawyer, and they were told Jerome has mental retardation, and it was the executive director of the Association of Retarded Citizens of Georgia at the time who talked to the board, they lifted the stay of execution, and they could have and should have said at that time, well, we can't execute him because, look, since he was 14 years old, it's been known that he had an IQ of 59. But because the board makes its own rules and is beholden to no one, as far as I can tell, what they did was they said, we'll lift the stay, we'll issue a stay of execution, but we're going to bring in our own psychologist to test him. Now, there was no reason to do that. They brought in a psychologist who was on the payroll of the prison system, as I understand it, and he did another IQ test, which they will not let us see. And then what happened was that psychologist made a report to the board. The board then came out of the meeting and they spoke freely to the press. And I'll tell you in a second why that is crucial. And they said, well, Dr. Knopf explained to us that Jerome has an IQ of 71. That put him just over the cutoff point of 70.
Right, the cutty is 70 or below.
That's right. Now, it turns out that was not true. His full-scale IQ, which is the IQ number you're supposed to go by, was actually below 70. The 71 was for one part of the IQ test. Now, we know from what the board chair at the time and other members of the board said to the press, we know that there were real problems with that psychologist's report. We've been asking since 2008 at a number of different times and through different people and directly just to see the test forms and the psychologist's report, if he wrote one, or an audio report, if his report to the board was recorded, because we want to have historical accuracy in our film, and that is in the public interest. And the lawyer for the board in 2008 said, if it's in the interest of historical accuracy, then we will release the information. So we explained that it was. We said, we got bits and pieces from what your board said to the press, but we need to see the whole picture. I'm a psychologist. I know that when you're giving an IQ test and you ask certain questions, you have to decide, is that worth 2 points, 1 point, or 0 points? I want to know how Dr. Knopf scored that test. I want it to be clear. We want to have a picture in the film of what his real IQ was, which was below 70. And here's why this matters. It matters desperately because as recently as a few weeks ago, the board again refused to divulge that information. They claim it's because of confidentiality. Yeah. Now, if there ever was any confidentiality, the board clearly waived that when they came out and spoke freely to the press. So what we have on the public record are the fragments of the whole picture. That is not in the interest of historical accuracy. Jerome is dead. His two closest sisters are dead. One of them had written to the board and asked that the information be given to us. And this is a First Amendment issue. And the public has the right to have that information.
If you're just joining us, my guests are psychologist Paula Kaplan and AJC reporter Alan Judd. We're talking about Georgia's execution of Jerome Bowden in the 1980s and the questions that still remain. Alan, Paula mentioned that Georgia became one of the first state, in fact, to bar executions of people with an IQ of 70 below. But one of the things that you report on, in fact, is that in this state they have the highest standard of proof for that designation. What does that mean?
Right. Well, look, a little background of that is that the 2002 Supreme Court case that Paula was mentioning basically said it's against the law to execute people with mental retardation. However, it's up to each state to determine whether that person falls in that category and using their own standards. So Georgia has this very high standard of clear and convincing evidence, I believe it's called. And it's much higher than most states. Most states would go with a preponderance of evidence, but Georgia has a standard that is very, very difficult to meet you know, and it's not just based on the IQ alone. It is based on the IQ and some other factors that aren't necessarily laid out for the public.
And are also quite different from other states.
Correct.
Let me just say something. This is important today. This is not just about a historical case from all those years ago. And the reason it's important today is that a lot of people think that because of the 2002 Supreme Court decision, Atkins v. Virginia, that nobody in this country is executing anyone who has this intellectual disability anymore. That's not true. And what's absolutely horrifying is that they are still managing to execute people with these low IQs in the same way that they did it to Jerome Bowden, which is that the state's attorneys, in this case, it was the Georgia Board of Pardons and Paroles, but this, the people who want to see someone executed, they bring in these hired gun psychologists. And as I mentioned, as a psychologist, there are things you can do that
to make skew the results.
Exactly. And so we need to know it's happening today,
right,
despite that decision.
Alan, this came up again just last year. So tell me about the execution of Warren Lee Hill.
Right. Hill had he was on death row for beating to death another inmate, and he was already in prison. He killed a cellmate. He had an IQ of 70.
Which is the cutoff point. It's supposed to be 70 or below.
Right. So despite that, the Board of Pardons and Paroles had a hearing in private. We don't know what was said. We don't know what information they had or what they based it on, but they declined to grant him clemency. So the execution was carried out last year.
How is it legal, though, if the cutoff is 70 or below for the I mean, I know we don't know why, but how is it legal for them to go ahead and move forward with the execution anyway?
The cutoff really is not a legal standard. That is a sort of a standard that's used by the profession, I believe, to look at intellectual disabilities. But the Supreme Court ruling in 2002 didn't
lay out
exactly what the standards would be. It's up to each state.
So, Paula, why do we have that particular standard of 70 or below? How did that guideline get established?
Briefly, if you look at the statistics, that means that someone is not just not all that intelligent, but significantly below average in intelligence. It's a statistical cutoff point, but two things to mention. One is that when you say someone has an IQ of 70, it's just like when you hear the election polls. That doesn't mean it's 70. It means it's somewhere between, say, 68 and 72. So this is not absolute science. The other thing is that according to the official definitions of what was called mental retardation, now intellectual disability, you don't just go on the basis of the IQ. And this is where psychologists who are hired guns can fudge things, because you're supposed to take other things into consideration, including how do they cope in everyday life activities. And that's often a matter of judgment. Which ones do you report? Which ones do you evaluate? And supposedly, they're supposed to have had a low IQ before the age of 18. Well, if someone gets a serious head injury and their IQ is now below 70, then do we really want to say, well, they used to be able to think clearly and function well and understand what execution means and understand the consequences of their actions, and now they can't? Well, too bad, they were able to do it before they committed the crime. What is it that we're doing to people here? This is about revenge and vengefulness. It's not about understanding what leads somebody to commit a crime or to sign a false confession.
So, Alan, where do we go from here? Because is there a possibility that anybody at any point could compel the clemency board to release documents like this if they were in search of perhaps a legal precedent?
It is totally up to them. They have total discretion about this. There's no accountability for the parole board. Even though the governor appoints them, the governor has no authority to instruct them on how to do anything. Once they are there, they are autonomous.
And not even the governor can demand to see the transcripts or the proceedings.
No.
There's no democracy. There's no democratic procedure here. They're interfering with the First Amendment, and they're getting away with it. This is shocking.
Well, the documentary is called American Justice, the Jerome Bowden Story. I've been speaking with Paula Kaplan, who's an associate at Harvard University's Du Bois Institute and was a producer on that film. And Alan Judd is a reporter for the Atlanta Journal-Constitution. Thank you both so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Is it too soon to think about Thanksgiving dinner? We're already in the mood for some very, very good food. And tomorrow we'll dedicate the hour to some of our favorite discussions about delicacies found in the South. I would love to know about actually the best meal you've ever had. Where was it? What was it? And have you ever been able to recreate it? Call us at 404-500-9457 to share the best meal stories you've got. And then be sure to join us Thursday at 9 a.m. for more. Now, let's take a moment to honor a very special Georgian.
Oh, my God. I am so lucky to be a Southerner. And when I talk about home, even though I've now lived in New York longer than I lived in Georgia, home is still Georgia.
That's Deborah Norville. The Dalton, Georgia native is the longtime host of Inside Edition. She also holds the record as the longest-serving female anchor on national TV. Deborah Norville was inducted into the Broadcasting and Cable Hall of Fame last month. We caught up with her to ask how her childhood in Georgia shaped her success in journalism.
I think that being a Southerner, being a Georgian, means that there's a certain solidness to your moral constitution. Family is holy. Community is what makes you who you are. The people who knew you growing up still know you best, because your character isn't formed when you're 40. Your character is formed when you're 10 and 14, and the experiences that you have then. I grew up in a community where you went to Tuesday night Bible study in somebody's carpet showroom, and so you lounged on the waterfalls of carpet samples as the Bible study leader talked about scripture. So I grew up in a place where they may not have known which one of the Norville girls I was. I'm one of four daughters, but they knew I was one of them, and I knew they knew. And that meant if you acted out, Mom and Dad were going to hear about it. It sort of enforces a certain type of behavior. You straighten up and fly right. And I think that sort of influenced my choices as an adult going forward. You work in New York, you work in a business where when I moved from Chicago to NBC in New York, somebody warned me, said, walk like a crab so they can't stab you in the back. But in fact, they'll stab you from the front. It's a tough business, this broadcasting thing. And yet I really think one of the reasons I've been able to survive as long as I have is because I was brought up in such a solid way. And, you know, your word is your bond. You don't fudge the rules. You know, God's watching. So you don't do stuff that maybe other people would be tempted to do. A month ago, I was back from my 40th high school reunion. And, you know, I think everybody sort of debates, do you go back for the reunion? Do you really? You know, you all have that little debate with yourself. I'm so glad I went back because it was very comforting. And maybe the nicest thing was to go over. One of my friend's father is 92 years old. She said, oh, God, Daddy would love to see y'all. So five of us went over to my friend's house, and we went in. And this was the first house that I had ever gone to for a sleepaway. So this girl has been a very, very dear friend for my entire life. And walked in there, and the father, you know, was in great shape, hale and hearty, talked about us, you know, asked everybody about their families. And then he said, Debbie, come in here. I want to show you something. And he led us into the living room. And on the wall in the living room, he has grandkids finger painting and all those kinds of special things that grandparents tend to paste up on their wall. Also taped up on there was a back page from Business Week magazine from earlier this year, where they had done a celebrity person in their office, and it was me. And this gentleman had ripped it out of the magazine and taped it up on the wall next to the artwork from his grandkids. And to me, that just underscored how much support I have had throughout my career, through the ups and the downs, from the people in my hometown. And I would have never known that he thought that fatherly of me if I hadn't gone over there and seen that article stuck up on his wall. It just made me feel very, very blessed to come from a small town. And there are small towns like this all over Georgia and all over America, where we're all rooting for each other.
Deborah Norville was born in Dalton, Georgia, and graduated from the University of Georgia in Athens. She was inducted into the Broadcasting and Cable Hall of Fame last month. Our thanks to production assistant Shannon Robinson for that story. You know, sometimes the best way to deal with serious subjects is to laugh about them. Comedian Trey Crowder uses humor to talk about politics and culture, and he's found a big following online. Trey calls himself the liberal redneck, and he seems to take a lot of pleasure in flouting some Southern stereotypes. He will perform in Georgia this week as part of the Well-Read Comedy Tour, along with fellow comics Corey Ryan Forrester and Drew Morgan. The three of them also have a new book out. It's called The Liberal Redneck Manifesto, Dragon Dixie Out of the Dark. And Trey Crowder joins me now. Good morning.
Good morning.
So, I mean, I have to start with saying you were right. You had said that people were not listening to people from the rural South or the middle of America. You said that they were dismissing them. And It sounds like that was true.
Yeah. You know, I don't take a whole lot of consolation in that, you know what I mean, personally. And I got to admit also, at the end of the day, I still didn't expect Trump to actually win. Like, I was worried about it, and I could tell people weren't, you know, they were underestimating his supporters or not taking them seriously or just didn't care to or whatever. And that I knew, or that was concerning to me, but I still didn't think we'd actually do it. So, I mean, I was pretty stunned myself last Tuesday, to be honest with you.
But that's one of the things that you have talked about. Let's actually hear you speaking. This is from the show Real Time with Bill Maher, Friday night, and they were talking about the surprise election of Donald Trump. And you're explaining that most Americans don't understand rednecks.
It's really drove it home for me, being on the road this year and talking to people all over the country who have been great, but how much they fundamentally don't understand and don't care to understand so many of these people. And I feel like a lot of this is a backlash from those people against that.
What is it that the rest of the country is not understanding about the struggles of what you refer to as rednecks, people in rural areas?
Well, they don't care to understand about their, like, struggles or anything they're going through. They don't even think about those people as far as just the stereotypes of them and how ignorant and stupid and backward and racist they are or whatever. You know what I mean? Like, that's about as far as their thought process even goes when it comes to those people. They never get to the struggle. You know what I mean? It's just like, oh yeah, the South, where everyone is an inbred hick. Right. Got it. You know, who wants kombucha? You know, like, that's about as far as it goes with a lot of these people. And so they don't understand them because they don't try, and they have no interest in trying, you know?
So I want to play a clip from a video you posted back in June, and your videos online have gotten millions of hits. And this was you warning Democrats and progressives to take Donald Trump supporters more seriously. But it sounds as though you felt a little surprised or I guess unbelieving as well.
When I see poor voters come out in droves for this guy in places like my hometown, where the unemployment rate's been double digits for 20 years and you're considered a rich kid if your daddy carried the mail, it blows me away. So if you get complacent and sit your ass on the couch come November, then we're all going to be getting what you deserve. So you need to run that burn under a cold tap and saddle back up, baby, because we ain't out the woods yet.
Do you feel as though there are things you were surprised by in terms of the election results?
Yeah, and I said some of this on Real Time on Friday, too, and I was talking yesterday with Corey and Drew about it. Like, so I grew up in the rural South in a place that, you know, came out heavily for Donald Trump, and I've been to a lot of other places just like it, and, like, I know these people, and I'm so utterly confident that if you went back, let's say, like, 4 or 5 years ago, because
let's go back to before the whole birther thing when he started going after Obama, who they are not a fan of. But if you went back that far to before Donald Trump was involved in any kind of politics at all and just polled these people on just their general opinion of Donald Trump, because he has been famous for 30 years, you know, and asked him, what do you think about Donald Trump? It would have been overwhelmingly negative because he's smug. He thinks he's better than everybody else. He's a rich silver spoon Yankee. Right? I mean, like, nothing about him just as a man would appeal to these people. And so that's why it was surprising to me, the fact that he has been able to sell them or get them to buy what he's selling. And what that says to me is that they truly were desperate for somebody to believe in or for somebody to even pretend to care about him, because he was the first one in forever to do that. And that shows me, again, how desperate a lot of these people were, because this is not a guy that was tailor-made for this audience, in my opinion. And I feel very, very confident in that.
My guest is comedian Trey Crowder. He performs stand-up tonight at the Georgia Theater in Athens and tomorrow night at Terminal West in Atlanta. The Atlanta performance is sold out, but Trey will sign copies of his new book tomorrow at 6 at the Georgia Tech Barnes & Noble. That book is called The Liberal Redneck Manifesto, Dragon Dixie Out of the Dark. Now, as I understand it, you have an MBA, right?
I do, yeah.
So
yeah,
how did
people find that out, and they're like, oh, that's neither liberal nor redneck. And I'm like, man, it was practical. I was trying to get out of the trailer. You know what I mean?
Well, but sure. My question is, how do you go from an MBA to becoming a stand-up comedian?
Well, like I said, the MBA, I mean, frankly, it was practical. Like, I always knew I wanted to be a comedian. I always knew I wanted to be an entertainer. But first and foremost, I had to get out of, my hometown and my situation, or what, I had no safety net at all. Like, there was nothing to fall back on, nobody to support me financially in that way or nothing like that. So the wisest course of action to me seemed to be to get a degree in which I could actually get a job and, you know, make money and pay the bills and whatever else while I pursued being a comedian. And I thought an MBA was, you know, the way to go as far as that goes. And that's pretty much, that was my entire reasoning for it.
It was your fallback?
Yeah. Yeah, basically.
And you haven't had to use it?
Well, no. I worked for 6 years out of college in a business setting while I've been moonlighting as a comedian that whole time. And I was only able to quit my day job as of this year, June of this year. I've been a full-time writer and comedian since then. But I worked with that, using my MBA for, 6 years before that.
Well, then let's talk a little bit about your videos, because that they are, like I said, they're in the millions of hits at this point. And you often are talking about stereotypes of the South, which seem to annoy you. Let's hear one. This is a video you made when there were billboards showing up that said "Make America White Again." They went up not too far from where you live. Here's your reaction.
Yeah.
American culture has improved dramatically since other races earned the right to make their presence known. I don't want to live in a country without trap music. F*** you, I'm trying to get turnt. And I don't think women are going to start shaking their asses to Kenny G, so to hell with making America white again.
What do you think about stereotypes of the South? Do you think that, especially as campaign season, have they strengthened those stereotypes, or are we starting to break through them?
No. Well, yeah, the election, I think, it did not help that image for sure, which is a shame. But no, I don't appreciate a lot of the Southern stereotypes. I mean, I get it. They're there for a reason. I'm not going to act like they're not. Like most stereotypes, they exist for a reason. There's some truth to it. But I mean, I just think that they're not, like most stereotypes, they're not really fair. Because, like, for example, that we're all racist or whatever. Almost every city in this country is racist or has, you know, elements of institutional racism. Where you go to any state in this country and you leave the city for, 30 miles in whatever direction, you start seeing the same types of things, you know what I mean, in rural parts of the country, everywhere. But a lot of people act like it's just the South. And so that's what bothers me about it. Like, these are wholly Southern problems when they're not at all.
Do you have to change your act when you're going to a place in the South as opposed to going to New York?
No, I never have done that. And frankly, it's gotten a lot easier for me this year because now people, they're coming to my shows. They know what they're getting when they walk through the door. You know what I mean? Like they're coming to see us, you know? And so
you mean because they've seen your videos online,
right? Yeah. So they're buying a ticket cause they're fans already, which makes a huge difference. But even before that, I've been doing the same thing. Like I've been doing my thing, if you will, on stage, mostly in the South for the past 6 years. And I've never really changed my act depending on where I was at. I mean, a little bit if I'm in a super, super redneck type bar show or something like that, there's one or two things I might not do, like about the Bible or something. But by and large, my act is what it's been, and I've done it all over the country. And I mean, honestly, as of now, we do even better in this. Our best shows, hands down, are in the South.
So we've got about a minute left, and I wonder if there were, as you became the so-called liberal redneck, were there awkward discussions with people that you knew growing up or family members?
Oh, yeah. Honestly, they mostly had to do with Jesus, because I'm not religious either. That's a big part of it, in fact. And those were what most of those discussions were about. Like, ain't you worried about your soul, man? Like all that kind of stuff. People could not believe that I would say that I would dare to say the things that I was saying, you know, for fear of being smoked or whatever. But yeah, I definitely had a lot of those conversations over the years. But the people closest to me my whole life have always been pretty much in line with me in that way.
Yeah.
So it's honestly never been that big of a deal to me, frankly. Like I've never, like a lot of people tell us they feel like they're living in the closet in the South as closeted liberals or closeted atheists or whatever.
Yeah.
And I never felt that way,
well,
frankly.
You're definitely
luckily
not closeted, Dre Crowder.
Now you're right.
Comedian, co-author of the Liberal Redneck Manifesto, Dragon Dixie Out of the Dark. Sure will be on stage tonight at the Georgia Theater in Athens and in Atlanta tomorrow to sign his new book at the Georgia Tech Barnes & Noble. The Atlanta show is sold out. Thank you so much.
Oh, thank you. It was a pleasure.